Let me ask you to take your Bibles, please, and go to James chapter 5 this morning. James chapter 5. Came across a quote recently that I ended up forwarding along to my sons, and I thought I'd share with you. It says, "The almighty dollar bequeathed to a child is an almighty curse. No man has the right to handicap his son with such a burden as wealth." And so I sent that to the boys and said I was trying to minister to them by making sure that that didn't happen. I wonder if we believe that, though. I mean, I wonder if you would think inheriting a fortune would bring a curse to you, or leaving one for somebody else would actually be harmful to them. I mean, my guess is we are so disinclined toward that without recognizing it because we live and move and are saturated in a culture that actually has elevated the good life as defined by material satisfaction, that we would find it hard to believe that you could be hurting somebody by giving them money. It doesn't sit well in our minds because we've lost some of what the Scriptures teaches very clearly about, for instance, a phrase that sometimes gets misquoted, but the love of money is the root of all evils. It's not money that is the root of all evils. It's the love of money which is the root of all evils. Or about Jesus warning about people who thought that their life consisted in the abundance of possessions and therefore were in danger of judgment. I mean, we just do not have a worldview shaped like that. And so the text we're going to look at, I'm thankful we're looking at the week after Mother's Day and not Mother's Day, because it is one that just sort of punches us right between the eyes about issues of wealth and riches and how we live in relationship to them. Look at James chapter 5, and I'd like to read all the way past our text for this morning just so you can see it in its context, okay? James 5:1, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which have been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord." And I'll just stop there because that therefore is the key that I wanted you to see. Here's a really, in a sense, an interesting passage in the book of James that raises a question in this regard. To whom is James speaking? I mean, is he actually talking to people who are in the church? Or is he doing something in literary terms that's called an apostrophe? That is, he's speaking about people who are not present for the benefit of people who are present. And it certainly seems that that is more likely than that James actually thinks that these people are believers. Because when you look at what he says about them, they are the kinds of words that are never used about those, as we've sung this morning, whose hope is secure, who have been the recipient of God's grace and therefore rescued from His wrath, because this text is about wrath. It is about judgment. It's about people who are going to come under judgment precisely because they have worshiped riches rather than God. And so it's striking. In many ways, what James seems to be doing here is what the prophets did at many times in the Old Testament, when all of a sudden in the midst of a book written for the people of Israel, you would hear a statement that would break out as a woe, for instance, against one of the nations around them. It was a declaration of what God was going to do in judging those who had defied him, even though it was being written to and spoken to God's people. And so when we look at this text, we need to read it and think about it in a sense, in a sort of a two-dimensional way. What does this have to say for those who know Christ, and what does this have to say for those who don't? Because I think it sits here with that kind of a powerful message for both groups. So what I'd like to do is really just walk through, in a sense, just explaining almost in a kind of way where we're just looking at the message of it and then come back and actually think about the ramifications of it. And I think it would be helpful for us to look at what James says here by sort of dividing it into three categories. The first is the character of God's judgment. And we need to understand something about what's going on. And if you look right at the beginning, verse 1, he says, weep and howl. And that, those are strong words, and I think intended, in a sense, to show us that this judgment is going to be the kind that is shocking. I mean, he's picking up language from the Old Testament in which they would announce a judgment that would cause the people, when they see it, to weep and howl over the disaster that was going to take place. I mean, it would be the kind of scene that if you were to come home and you found your home absolutely demolished today, the kind of devastation that would happen if you, as you look at it and you go, it's all gone. And that's exactly the way James wants them to think, because the things that they've accumulated and put their trust in are going to be wiped out. And it ought to provoke in them, when they see this judgment, a kind of shock and horror at it because of how terrible it will be. And in fact, that leads us, I think, as you look at the words, to see that this judgment is going to be severe. It's described in verse 1 as miseries. If you look down into verse 3, it's described as consuming your flesh like fire. If you look down to verse 5, it talks about a day of slaughter. I mean, their riches will rot and rust, verse 2 says. Your riches have rotted, your garments become moth-eaten, your gold and silver have rusted, and their rust will witness against you. I mean, it's a picture of the severity of what's going to happen. The things that they've accumulated, their garments, their riches, their gold and silver, are presented as basically just being eaten up and destroyed. They'll rot and rust. They actually have no permanence, and they will in fact be wiped out. And he goes beyond that. Not only will their riches rot and rust, those very riches will testify against them. Look at the language in verse 3. It says, they will be a witness against you. That word witness is the one that we often associate with evangelism. They will testify of you. And the idea here, like really in evangelism, is a testimony in a courtroom. Right? You call a witness to give their testimony. They're presenting some evidence or something which has an effect of either vindicating, but usually convicting somebody. And here's what James is saying. The stuff that you had built your life around and had stockpiled, you've stockpiled it for this very reason. It's going to be the witness against you. It will be the testimony that leads to your conviction as having defied God. And so instead of it being the source of their bounty and pleasure and joy, it's ultimately going to be the witness that results in God's judgment on them, which was described as miseries. And that will compound, their riches actually will compound their judgment, not rescue them from it. I mean, look at the end of verse 3. We'll come back to this, but it says, it is in the last days you've stored up your treasure. The fact is that we'll have to think about this a little bit more when we start to wrestle with application of it. But James is not commending them for having stored up this treasure, right? And I think that much is clear, right? I mean, it's they've got riches and garments and gold and silver, and he says, you've stored all of that up actually in a day of slaughter. You've done it in the last days in such a way that these things will be the convicting witness against you and, in fact, practically speaking, be the cause of the judgment which consumes your flesh. You're not going to be protected from harm by them like we're inclined to do, right? We pile up resources to insulate us from trouble. And what he's actually saying is you've basically provided the basis for your trouble. You've actually brought it not to rescue you, but to condemn you. Then look at down at the end of verse 4, because here's a phrase or a description of the Lord that probably the only time we encounter it with any regularity is in a mighty fortress is our God. And when we sing that phrase, Lord Sabaoth, his name from age to age the same. And it's here at the end of verse 4, and what it means is, and some of you may have footnotes next to it in your Bibles, it's the Lord of hosts is really the idea. And it's a picture of God as the one who rules over the armies of heaven and everything that he's made. And so what James is trying to make sure we're clear here, that this isn't going to be some kind of impersonal judgment that just happens, right? Which probably the quote I gave you is supposed to be from Carnegie. And he's thinking, you know, you load someone up with wealth, it's actually not a blessing, it's a curse for them. My guess is he's looking at it on a purely horizontal plane, because you and I mean, we see this all the time, right? How many times does somebody, you know, after wasting all kinds of money, actually finally hits the jackpot on the lottery, and their life is not made great, it's actually destroyed? Or how many times have there been people we've seen in our culture that have signed a contract for more money than most of us will ever see in a lifetime, they'll get in 1 year, and not too many years later, they're broke, not just financially, but morally. Their families are destroyed because money had that kind of problem. And so someone might say it's like a, you know, it's just a seed and harvest kind of thing. And there is some aspect of that. But what James wants us to understand is this is not just some kind of law of harvest going on here. This is not some sanctified version of karma that's going to happen. This is actually going to be personal judgment from a holy and righteous God about what's going on. It is the Lord of hosts who's going to bring these miseries on them, that's going to be the one who executes the judgment that has actually, when he comes, we're just so ill prepared for this kind of strong language. Because the idea that God's judgment is going to be a day of slaughter is just almost, we've been so sensitized by a softened kind of misrepresentation of biblical truth that we almost think, really, no, God wouldn't do that. He won't slaughter his enemies. And when we do that, we have to sort of overlook a lot of the Bible. In the Old Testament, we have to sort of read the book of Revelation with rose-colored glasses, Because the fact is that these are God's enemies, and Christ will come and will defeat his enemies in a very powerful way, and it will engage in an act of judgment against unrighteousness. And it will be God who does that, not just the natural collapse of the walls of their life. And so he wants us to see this. This is a kind of shocking and severe judgment that comes from the very hand of a sovereign God. So why? Why is this judgment so intense? Well, that's what verses 2 through 5 really, 2 through 6 really are actually laying out for us, is the reason why this judgment is going to come on them. And let's just look, we'll just stick pretty close just to the surface of what the text says, because I don't think we have to find hidden meanings here. In verses 2 and 3, it's because they've hoarded riches for themselves, right? And the key to that is the last part of verse 3. You have stored up your treasure. And 2 and 3 have been laying out what that is. Riches, garments, gold and silver. They have stockpiled these things, and what he's doing is using them as signs or indicators or markers of their riches, the kinds of things that they have sought to pile up and accumulate in order to establish themselves as rich, as those who have these things. In fact, go back to chapter 2 for just really a couple seconds, and you can see a little bit that this is culturally then like it is now. Look at 2:2. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes. Remember, and he describes those kinds of people as rich in verse 6. So when he comes back in chapter 5 and describes the rich in terms of these kinds of temporal markers, they show off their wealth by what they wear and how they display it and what they've accumulated. He says, here's the problem. You've hoarded those things. You've stored them up, hoarded them rather than used them the way God would intend you to. Okay, and we'll come back to this in the application point, because, you know, obviously it immediately sort of raises the question, is the Bible against any kind of savings? And the answer to that would be clearly no, because we're actually commanded, for instance, in Proverbs 6, to learn from the ant who in the summer goes and gathers so he has something in the winter. And to not do that is being described as a sluggard. So clearly, God is not opposed to saving. So there must be some kind of difference between the kind of hoarding that they've done and legitimate preparation for future need. Right? And I think there's part of the key to it. Theirs wasn't a preparation for future need. It was actually piling up for themselves. It was that they had made themselves the center of things rather than the servant of God and the things that he's given to them. Look at verse 4. They have robbed other people. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which have been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. So here's an act of injustice on their part. Apparently the primary intention in terms of the immediate focus point would be rich landowners who have laborers who mow the fields and harvest for them, and rather than give them what was rightfully theirs, they've withheld it. I mean, in a sense, it may be, and I think it is a little bit picturesque, the way James says it, is it sort of gives the idea that the money that ought to be in the hands of the laborer is actually in the pocket of the owner. And notice what's crying out the first time. It's the wages crying out. He sort of personifies the wages as if stuck in that money bag of the owner or the pocket of the owner. Those wages are crying out about the wrongness of it. And that's not an uncommon way in which the Bible would address things. Remember when Cain killed Abel? What did God say about the blood of Abel? It cries out to me from the ground. Right? What it is a picturesque way of God saying, I know about what's happened here. The injustice and unrighteousness that has been committed has not escaped my notice. It is speaking against you, and as well as those who did the harvesting, raising up their voice against them. So they had robbed others of what was rightfully theirs. Then verse 5, they've lived for pleasure. Okay, they've lived in a hedonistic kind of way. You've lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. Some other translations, I think, help us see, not that they're different than New American Standard, but just sort of the flavor in which the Greek language could be translated. You have spent your years on earth in luxury, satisfying every desire. Or you have lived in luxury and self-indulgence. There's the issue. I mean, is God against pleasure? No. He's given us all things, 1 Timothy 6 says, richly to enjoy. What he is against is sinful and selfish pleasure. He's against making pleasure the goal rather than a gift from God to be enjoyed for God's glory. Right? Because any pleasure that you experience, which is against or outside of God's will, is not an acceptable pleasure. And this is where it gets more deep, probably everybody, I would hope, would agree with that. I mean, we can't pursue pleasure outside of the will of God. But it's also possible for us to seek pleasure as an end in itself. That we enjoy it, not as a gift from God, but as something that we actually serve. Something that we have made the object of our longing, we've made actually the focus of our lives. And that's what he's talking about here, that they, instead of seeing wealth, and I'm using it in a broader category like verses 2 and 3 do, that is riches, garments, gold and silver, rather than seeing the material blessings that God had allowed them to have as a gift from his hand to be used for his glory, part of which would be enjoying it in a worshipful way, they actually had let it terminate on them. This is about me and what I want, to the exclusion of what God wants done with the things that he has allowed me to have. I mean, the rich fool in Luke is a perfect example of that, right? I mean, Jesus is confronted with a family problem. Someone says to him, teacher, tell my brother to give me my portion. And so basically it's a family financial fight, and so they want this guy wants Jesus to be his advocate. And Jesus tells them a parable of a man who had a harvest and said, what will I do? I'll do is I'll tear down these barns and build bigger. And then I'll eat, drink, and be merry. In essence, he said, this surplus that I have is all going in my pocket. It's all going to be about me. And Jesus then in the parable says, you fool, this night God will require your soul, then who shall these things be? And then Jesus says the point of the parable. So is everyone who is rich toward himself and not toward God. See, that's the point. It wasn't that he was productive. It wasn't, in fact, that he had resources. It was that he thought those resources terminated with him. He thought he was a holding pen rather than a conduit. He thought, this is all about me. And that's exactly what James is after. People who live for their own self-indulgence are those that James is addressing. And then look at verse 6. They have oppressed the righteous. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. And it's most likely that this is an issue of legal oppression, that the word condemned tends to have that flavor to it. This is not, I mean, it's certainly not strange even to our culture, although our culture has many built-in protections against this kind of thing, right? But there's a very long history of the rich being able to manipulate the legal system to their own advantage and to the oppression of those who don't have resources. I mean, even today, you know, you can hear people say, you know, this company or this person defrauded me. Someone says, you know, sue them about it, take them to court, and a potential objection in their mind is, I will run out of money before I can ever get justice in this. And they know that they've got the resources, and sometimes, you know, we love TV shows, and go ahead, I'll tie you up in court, you know, to your grandkids, right? Essentially, it's I've got the power here because I have the resources so I can force you to do what I want. I can actually begin to close in on what you do have and take it away. Potentially, if it's like verse 4, right? That they didn't give the wages to them, and that person says, I need my wages, and the wicked rich man says, do something about it. Do something about it. And so this man has no food to take care of his family, or in fact, not able to pay bills, and then instead of aiding the person, they actually make them their slave. If you read the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah has this problem going on. The wealthy landowners are selling food to the poor people. When the poor people run out of money, they require them to sell their kids into servitude, sell themselves as slaves so they can actually live, right? And they're having to do that because if they didn't, then what they had would be taken away. They'd be condemned, and in fact, sometimes that resulting in death because of deprivation. I mean, that's what he's talking about here. Why does James highlight the righteous man here? Is it intending to equate, and this is probably a question that would tie up with the rich too, is James here equating riches with evil and poorness with righteousness? I don't think there's biblical basis for saying that. Certainly not the best way to interpret this. I think probably the easiest solution is if it's legal trouble and the person's actually guilty, then you're not oppressing them to condemn them, right? I mean, so the sin would be condemning the righteous. There's nothing wrong with condemning the unrighteous. So he just highlights the fact that the evil in your heart is being expressed by the fact that people who do not deserve this are being afflicted by you because of it. And so he's talking about people who are operating from an evil heart against those who are unjustly being condemned and affected by it. And in fact, I think the last part of verse 6, he does not resist you, is really intended as a statement of the fact that he can't. Right? I mean, what can he do? I mean, it could be as simple as, what am I going to do? I can't do anything. I have no recourse. I have no ability to protect myself here. And James is saying, do you realize the wickedness of you using what you have to destroy people who have no ability to protect themselves? They're vulnerable precisely because of their lack, and it ought to evoke compassion and mercy in you, but instead it's provoking greed and avarice. That's the point of the condemnation to them. They're not looking to help those who need help. They're looking to take advantage of people precisely because they're needy. I mean, you know, again, we're a little bit buffered by the relative prosperity that we live in. Okay, because most of us probably have not had to go days without food. We've got brothers and sisters who attend here who have had to flee their homelands because of the kind of stuff that this passage is talking about. Most of us don't live right now in a culture in which we actually feel the kinds of oppression that this is talking about. And so it seems a little distant to us. But the reality of it is that was the world in which they lived, and the motivations of heart which produced it are still present. I mean, it is still true that people hoard for themselves riches, that people take or keep from others what is properly theirs, but we make it ours. That people live for pleasure, that people take advantage of those who are needy. I mean, that's what this text is about. And here's the thing that should sober us for a moment. Those are the reasons why God says it will result in misery, in flesh being consumed, in a day of slaughter. These are economic evils that provoke a very powerful reaction by a righteous and holy God, because all we have to do is think about this in terms of the two great commandments, love for God and love for your neighbor, and here at the center of it, riches have the potential of defying both. We love them more than we love God, and rather than use them for the good of others, we love ourselves to the exclusion or harm of others. I mean, so it's not just like a financial problem, it's a root heart problem that James is after. He also, in these verses, emphasizes the closeness of this judgment that's coming. And you can see that if you go back up to verse 1, and look at the last part of the verse. It says, for your miseries which are coming upon you. And James puts that in what we call the present tense, because he's describing it as something that is on its way. He's wanting them to see. I'm not talking about something way down there at the end of the line. You need to see that this is on its way. It is coming. Okay, it is on its way here because of the time in which we live. He describes that in verse 3. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. And certainly, if we're honest, that probably has a little less oomph to it than it ought to, because the last days began with the ascension of Christ until his return. And so clearly it's been almost 2,000 years for that, so we can sort of start to be like the people in 2 Peter, it's not going to get here in my lifetime. But James is saying to them, this whole era in which we live is the end. It's the last days. And you're doing this in the time right before Christ will come back to judge. And that judgment is coming. In fact, he can see it. He can see it so clearly and certainly that he describes it, as I've alluded to a couple times now, in verse 5 at the end of it. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. And that's a graphic kind of picture, isn't it? I mean, again, if you've not had any farm experience, it may not resonate immediately, but basically the picture is like the end of the prodigal son, right? Get the fattened calf. Or, you know, you're fattening up that animal for the feast that you're going to have. And here's what he's saying. All of this that you've been stuffing yourself with is basically you've just fattened your heart up for the day of slaughter. I mean, that's supposed to evoke a kind of fear in them, that they're ready to, in fact, come under God's judgment at any moment. And that's why I read down into verse 7. Look at the first part of verse 7. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. And drop now into verse 8. You too be patient, strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. So James is painting out for them a picture of imminent or impending judgment. Which if you're, I mean, clearly James has a theological, a doctrinal perspective that says Christ ascended to heaven, he told us he's coming back again, and he could come at any moment. So that frames it, right? And clearly throughout James' life, that did not happen. Up to this point, it has not happened. But let me ask you this, all right? Do you think the people who have heard James's warning from the time James issued it to now had the end come quicker than they expected? I mean, even in our day, I mean, people die at 80 and we go, oh, so soon. And in one hand, it's like, really? On another, it is, you know, life passes really quickly. And so even if Jesus doesn't come back, we humans will go to judgment much sooner than we think. And we waste humanity, waste its life and its resources, really trying to dull the reality of that. I don't want to think about that, so I'm going to pour myself into and my resources into, sadly, the title of a supposedly Christian book, My Best Life Now. I'm going to have a blast while I last. And so James's warning is about the fact that this is rapidly approaching, and it's rapidly approaching for every one of us in this room. It'll be here before you know it. And it will be the assessment that God has warned us about. So let me draw out of here, I think, when we think about it in terms of the original audience and us this morning, three what I would consider to be applications of it. The first is this, that this text actually should bring rest to some people. And that's those who are robbed of their rightful properties in verse 4 and oppressed by those who have more power and wealth than them in verse 6. Because they can rest, verse 4 clearly indicates to us that they can rest in God's knowledge of their situation. Right? That's what James is wrapped up in. What James is saying here is this: the wages you deserve that were not given to you, those are crying out to God. And your cries to God are being heard. You're not outside of the scope of God's knowledge. It's not as if this is happening to you under some shield and God doesn't know that you have been harmed. God doesn't know that you've been exploited. God doesn't know that you've been oppressed. What James is saying is this cries out to God. He knows about it. He is aware of it. It is not being lost on God. And certainly in the primary application of this, it has to do with those who are facing this kind of economic exploitation and oppression by those who oppose. But I think there's enough evidence in Scripture to say that applies across the board. That's why in verse 7 and 8, it talks about us having patience and enduring, being willing to suffer until the time when God does, because God knows. He's aware of it. He understands what you've experienced, and you can rest in that. But not just his knowledge of it. This passage would be calling us to rest in God's justice regarding their situation. And that's the point of this being a text of judgment that leads to an application of patience, because God will deal with this. And again, we need to think more carefully than sometimes we think, right? Because what I would say is that the Bible, The Bible actually establishes for us two apparently contradictory attitudes in our heart. One is that we should delight in mercy. That is, even those who have sinned against us, God calls on us to love our enemies, to have pity on them and want to see them rescued from the wrath to come. And yet, in the other hand, there is supposed to be, in fact, a delight in justice. That we want to see righteousness prevail, which means inevitably that unrighteousness will be judged. I mean, that's holding those two things in our hands is the only way we can explain, for instance, something like what Paul says in Romans 12 when he says, never take your own revenge. What's he say? Leave room for the wrath of God. He doesn't say, wipe that whole revenge or vengeance or vindication thing out of your mind. He's saying, you need to leave that to God because God will take care of this. God will deal with this. And that's exactly what this passage is intended to do. Because, and I think it's because the Bible speaks really to us. I guess the way we'd say it in our day is authentically. I mean, it's speaking to our real situation. Okay, because if we have ever been seriously and grievously sinned against, it doesn't actually satisfy the heart to just act like it didn't happen. To act like it's all okay. There is something deep in us because we're made in the image of God that has a longing, a crying out for justice. Sin needs to be punished. It must be punished. Okay, and that's what this text is saying. What they're doing will come under God's judgment. And those who have been the recipients of this wickedness and this evil can rest in the fact that God will take care of this. I don't have to. I don't have to strike my enemy. I don't have to cheat those who've cheated me. I don't have to take my vengeance. God's justice is real and certain. So it should produce patience or rest in the heart of those who've been sinned against in this way. I believe this text also calls on us, really those who know Christ particularly, or let me be more clear, those who profess to know Christ certainly need to reflect on what this passage is saying. For instance, about the temporary and transient nature of riches. I mean, they're like a garment that's going to rot and get eaten by moths. It's going to decay so that it has no lasting value. I mean, it will not pass the fire. It will not last. It is temporary and, in fact, fleeting. You know, the scriptures use that picturesque image that they mount wings and fly away. And that's what James is trying to communicate in the first part of this, that you and I need to understand that wealth is such a foolish god, small g, because it has no lasting power and permanence. I mean, it is a temporary thing that is fleeting in its nature. So if we worship it, we've really taken a very short duration of all of eternity and elevated to the place of priority. And in fact, we've fixed our hopes on something that needs our help. Right? Because if your god, Mammon, was really a god, you wouldn't have to worry about your bank account. It could sustain itself. You wouldn't have to worry about your house. You wouldn't have to worry about your health. You wouldn't have to worry about all those things, but that God can't deliver. So it's not worthy of worship and service. It's not worthy of making it your life's ambition. It's not worthy of putting your trust in the uncertainty of riches, as Paul says. But I think it also should cause us to reflect on the temptations of riches, that we might be tempted like them to live for them, right? That's what's at stake here. They actually have made their riches the object of their life, the goal of their life. And you and I might be tempted to do the same. So let me ask you some questions that perhaps you need to ask yourself, as I've tried to ask myself, because this is a tough one. How do you know the difference between saving properly and hoarding? How do you know the difference between enjoying God's good gifts and, in fact, being owned by them? How do you know the difference between having things and those things having you? Right? There's no easy answer to that. But it's the kind of thing that we have to probe our heart about. I mean, I think questions like, do you spend more than you have? You know, as I was thinking this weekend about this, I kept thinking back to that commercial. Some of you may not remember because it's been a while, but that guy that, you know, it pans a huge house, a beautiful car, backyard decorated, and he's walking with his lawnmower, smiling, going, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. And that's what I mean. Right? Do you have all kinds of stuff that you co-own with everybody else because you can't restrain your ability to spend until you actually have the money? You've got to spend it now to get it now. I think that would reflect a heart that is actually living for those things rather than using what God's given you. You're actually not content with what God's given you. You want to have more than He's given you, and you want it now. And so there are people who are paying for two lives, the one they lived yesterday and the one they're living today, and working on a third by piling up stuff for tomorrow. And riches have become the control center of why you do what you do. It's your heart. Do you spend so much that you can't give or save? And I'm desperately tempted to put can't in quotes there, right? Because it's not really true most of the time. I mean, 30 years ago, 30, probably 31, 32, my wife and I came to the conclusion that as long as we could drink Diet Coke, we were not hurting. Because water comes free from the tap. So as long as I'm buying something to drink, I'm doing way better than most of the people in this world. And yet some of us would go, well, I can't put anything to prepare for tomorrow, or I can't give to the Lord. And it's because we're just consuming whatever comes to us. We're living like verse 5 talks about. Here's one you might not think about. Are you saving so much that you can't give? There are some folks, the percentage of their income that's going into their retirement accounts radically eclipses the percentage they give to the Lord. I mean, it's not even close. And here's what they're saying. I'm putting some forward, but I'm not putting it forward past the date of my death. I'm going to put it to take care of me here. And because we're living like that, we're not obeying what God says about the use of our riches, which are a sufficiency for our needs and an abundance for every good deed. Are you sending more on ahead of you to heaven than you will leave behind? Didn't Jesus say to lay up treasure in heaven where it can't be stolen and can't decay? I mean, some of us in this room may have more of an idea about what we want to leave behind us than what we've sent on in front of us. And just think about what that suggests about the orientation of your life. What matters most to you at that point? It's here, not there. And I cracked a joke at the beginning about not leaving money for my kids, and I'm not intending to say that it's wrong for you to do anything like that. What I would be saying to you, though, if all you intend to do with what God has supplied to you for your life is pass it out for others to live on and enjoy in this life, rather than to say, how can I mobilize it for the greatest eternal benefit? Then you need to wrestle with what Jesus is saying. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, but in heaven. It is not wisdom that would cause you to do that. Do you spend more time thinking about your spending and saving than your soul? I mean, do you carry anxiety because your focus is on spending and accumulating and saving? Do you spend more time thinking about that? What am I going to do to get this resource or to have this resource or to take care of this issue? Your attention is on mammon more than your soul? I mean, an average day, an average week, an average month, how much time are you spending cultivating your soul as compared to checking your accounts? I mean, seriously. Because these are heart issues, and we need to recognize that there is a temptation in a world of affluence like we live in to have ourselves subtly twisted into living for mammon. And Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. You'll love the one and hate the other. You cannot serve God in material things. And that's why James can speak so powerfully about this. There is the temptation with riches that we might measure our lives by them. I mean, do you look at the success of your life based on what you've accumulated? I mean, are you going to look and say, hey, when I die, if I can hit this number, I'll have had a good life? Okay, and I'm not saying that there shouldn't be some thought about what you need to help yourself when you're unable to work, right? Because there's no biblical command to retire. There is something about financial independence. That is, when I can't work, I have to take care of myself and those that are dependent on me. So I need to prepare for that. Okay? It is not, I want to get to a certain day and then I can just have fun. And I got to have enough money to have a lot of fun. You're not going to find that in the scriptures. So are you thinking that the measure of your life will be, we have X amount, so now we can have a great time? Because I hate to break it to you, folks. You might not have very much time to spend it, and you have wasted your life. I mean, you have spent 65 years piling up money for the last 5 to 25, and you don't make it 6 months. And you will have wasted your life if that's what you lived for. And you cannot let riches become that. Do you benchmark your life by your possessions? Do you look at your house, your car, your clothes, and think, life's good? I mean, read 2 and 3 again. That's exactly what they were. Do you count it by your toys? I mean, it's ridiculous to me that people pride themselves on how much they spend. Man, that was great. We spent $300 on that meal. As if Spending a lot of money makes it good. All that is arrogance in an affluent culture. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having spent that money, but if you gauge the value of it by how much you spent on it, then you're showing what matters to you. It was the money as the marker of your success. And that's the problem that he's touching. Do you realize that it's possible for you to misuse what you've been entrusted with? You spend them in ways that harm your soul. You spend them in ways that distract you from worshiping and serving Christ. And here's the problem, all right? This is the, you know, I learned a long time ago as a preacher that the people who are not here will never hear me. Okay, so you're all here today. So I'm going to say it to you, and in a sense, it's for the people who are not here because of this, but you might be tempted next week. It is a horrible shame in our culture that we mark off success by having accumulated enough money to skip worship, to be able to run away on weekends, to go off by ourselves, to pursue fun that actually takes us away from worshiping and serving God. We actually start to think of that as the mark of a good life. I want to get to the point where I can run off. And do we see that that wars against our soul? I mean, do you see what the devil has tricked professing believers into thinking? That it's more valuable to take the Lord's Day and turn it into a recreational opportunity than the day designed by God to replenish our souls and for us to serve Him? If you've been around, you know I'm not against vacation. Okay, I'm not saying that. I'm talking about the mindset of our culture that actually makes our material prosperity war against the prosperity of our soul. Because we subtly think that would be fun, that would be good. Man, that it would be so nice to be able to go do that. And you know where you pick that up? You picked it up from watching a culture around us via movies and TV and conversations among people who have no thought of God. And all of a sudden it starts to filter in so that we put God in the back seat instead of the driver's seat. Do you recognize that it's possible that you might sin to gain or keep riches? Do you pay what you owe? Do you keep what isn't yours? Do you take what isn't yours? I mean, that's what this text would be after. And it might be possible for people who profess faith in Christ to actually be letting money control their ethics by not doing what God says to do, to get it, to keep it, to spend it. And so that leads us really, I think, to the sort of bottom line reflection on this, or actually call. And that is that I believe, as I said a few weeks ago, whenever God gives a warning, it is an extension of His mercy. I mean, when God says, weep and howl, He's not saying directly repent, but what He's saying is, I think, what Jesus would say, do not fear Him who can destroy your body, but fear Him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. And Jesus established there that if somebody really understands what matters most, then they would look at a passage like James is saying here, and they would go, if that has been my heart, if that has been the pattern of my life, that is what's coming, and I need to repent. I need to flee from the wrath to come, because it will be a horrible, horrible thing for a person to have enjoyed all the benefits of this world and die and awaken to the agony of God's judgment. Do you know the parable of Lazarus and the rich man? The rich man fared sumptuously, was clothed in fine linen, and the poor man had nothing, but he had faith. And there was a great reversal that took place at death. The rich man's riches could not prevent God's judgment. And you remember the words of Abraham in that parable? You in your life. That is, all of the best and good that you will ever experience happened in your life. And everything is downhill horrifically outside of Christ. And yet with Christ, there can be the experience of deprivation because you know it's not permanent and it's not purposeless. Because God, the true and living God, and His Son, Jesus Christ, is returning to rectify all unrighteousness, to rescue those who've trusted in Him. Let's bow together, please, in prayer. Lord, you know, I mean, the very teachings of your Son, He put His finger on this problem again and again. Almost a third of His parables confronted the tendency for us to love riches. He warned about their deceitfulness and the cares of this world, choking out the word. And so, Lord, help us to examine our own hearts, because there's no one-size-fits-all budget. There's no one-size-fits-all handling of finances. But there is a one-size-fits-all issue of the heart. We cannot serve you and mammon. We cannot love this world and love you. And so, Lord, help us to see that. Help us to see how the sinister creeping in of materialism could corrupt our hearts. Help us to declare truly and genuinely that we would rather have Jesus than anything else. We ask it in His name. Amen.